is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, and today will be better than yesterday. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home in Montana. Taylor Schwenk is actually at ESPN today. Taylor, what's going on?
Not much, Buster. In here to check out a taping of the L. Duncan Show, which you can watch on ESPN2 at 2 o'clock on Thursdays. You can watch them on YouTube. You can listen on this platform. Our friend Sarah Abbott at the helm on that one. But, nice to pop into Bristol every now and then.
Very nice. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how you can tear yourself away between Lola, your daughter, Dolly, your dog, and Jackson Holiday. I can't believe you actually have left in your home. I mean, the Schwenk Studios right now are the place where you live.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I was trying to get Lola to sleep, and then the Orioles, they came back. We're recording this on Thursday. It's running on Friday, but Wednesday night, the Orioles raged back against the Red Sox and was in danger of waking Lola up as we were trying to put her to sleep, but it's all good.
Nice. All right, so our new tradition on Friday, we're going to give you our top five teams. I don't think they've moved that much. I've got the Braves being number one, Dodgers two, Yankees, Orioles, Rangers. That's my 1 through 5 this week. But more interesting to me, Taylor, is how would you arrange the teams at the bottom? Okay, because we got four teams right now working hard to be at the bottom of the baseball standings. You got the Rockies at 3-8. An open question of how relevant they are. The A's, they're the A's, for God's sake. The Marlins, 2-11. In the post-Kim-Ang era, okay, which we'll never understand what that was all about. And the White Sox were 2-10, and it feels like every day you read about a White Sox player getting hurt.
I think I think out of this mix here, I think we got to leave the A's out. I feel like they've been a little bit scrappier the last couple of days. I think they avoid the bottom three for this week.
Even though they, we're talking about the Sacramento A's, the team that's not trying, the total disaster, you would put them ahead of the Rockies? I don't know. I just couldn't do it. I mean, they would have to win more games. Okay? I need more sample size.
Well, they've won more games than the Rockies, the Marlins, and the White Sox right now. So that's got to count for something at least this week.
And probably combined, yeah. Oh, the White Sox situation just seems to get worse by the day. Just with all that's going on. I feel bad for Pedro Grifol, their manager, right? Who it just feels like he hasn't had a fair shot to show what kind of manager he could be at the big league level. All right. Some news and notes as we get going here today. Shohei Ohtani's ex-interpreter faces federal charges, sources say. This is first reported by the New York Times, subsequently confirmed to ESPN. The New York Times reported that Ipe Mitsuhara is in negotiations to plead guilty. He faces federal charges to his alleged theft of millions from Ohtani, a source confirmed to ESPN. In a pair of interviews with ESPN, Mitsuhara initially said he amassed huge gambling debts and Ohtani helped him by wiring money to him. But hours later, Mitsuhara changed the story, saying Ohtani had no knowledge of the payments. Ohtani's attorney said the Dodgers star has been a victim of a quote-unquote massive theft. I mentioned the White Sox injuries. Yoan Moncada went to the injured list. He's going to miss at least 3 months. Could miss up to 6 months after suffering a left hip strain, the team announced on Wednesday. Just all kinds of guys going down on that team. Eloy Jimenez, Luis Robert, just terrible. Max Scherzer spoke with reporters and said he feels ahead of schedule in his return to the Rangers. We kind of got a hint about this just before the start of the season when the Rangers declined to put him on the 60-day injury list, which tells you he could be back sometime middle of May, maybe third week of May. We'll see how that goes. He had surgery last fall on his back. The Orioles, Jackson Holiday, we talked a lot about on the podcast on Wednesday. He went hitless in his major league debut, but he looked good in the field. Here was Jackson in the second inning.
2-1 against Yoshida, batting at .222 in the season. The next pitch hit on the ground out to second base. Fielded by Holiday, flips to second, one off to first. It's a double play. Jackson Holiday gets involved, starting the 4-6-3 double play ball.
And while he didn't get a hit in his first game, he did get his first major league RBI.
Kowser at third, Westberg at second. The pitch. Jackson, a roller to the right side. It's picked up on the ground by Reyes. On to first to get the out, but scoring on the play is Kowser, and Jackson Holiday has his first major league RBI. And it's a 5-3 Boston lead.
That from WBAL. The Orioles win that game 7-5. After the game, Jackson Holiday was asked about making his debut.
Was it pretty much as you imagined it would be?
Yeah, obviously I would have liked to gotten a few hits, but I mean, the overall experience was pretty incredible tonight to be able to go out there and win and have an RBI. I mean, it's pretty awesome just to be here.
The Marlins faced the Yankees. The Marlins won this game 5-2. Giancarlo Stanton did reach a milestone along the way.
High drive. Right field. Wow. Sanchez looking. See ya. Way back in right field. The Yankees are on the board. Stanton with a home run. It's 4-1 Marlins.
Stanton with a home run now against all 30 Major League Baseball teams. The Marlins were the last, naturally, because that's the team that he played with at the beginning of his career. The Guardians and the White Sox and the Naylor brothers had themselves a day.
Here's the 1-1. Swung on, and there's a high fly ball. Deep right center field, way back there. Home run, Naylor. He continues to torture the White Sox, and the Guardians are on the board. It's now 5-1, Chicago. Here's Bo Naylor with a runner at first, two down, 5-1. White Sox leading, and Naylor drives one deep center. This has a chance, and it goes. Home run, Bo Naylor. Both Naylors go deep this inning. And it's now a 5-3 game. Guardians inching closer.
The Guardians won this game 7-6. That sound from WTAM 1100. Our friend Sarah Langs has some notes about that. We're going to hear from Todd Radom today. And Carl Ravitch is going to talk about Ohtani and our Sunday night game and all kinds of stuff going on around baseball. Taylor, what else you got?
Buster, I previously mentioned the L. Duncan Show, which is taping right now and should be out by the time that you are listening to this. They're doing an NBA awards show. I know they always like to have fun over there, and they're talking a little Caitlin Clark off of L's run doing the women's Final Four in the women's tournament. Have a smash hit, her studio coverage there. So check out the L. Duncan Show on this podcasting platform or on YouTube. And Buster, while they might not be top five, we'll talk about this a little bit later. The Royals, I would say, knocking on the door at number six.
Oh, yeah. I'm loving the Royals. I've got some thoughts about the Royals. Going to have that conversation with Carl Ravitch coming up.
All aboard. It's the Rabbit Train with Carl Ravitch on Baseball Tonight.
The Rabbit Train, Carl Ravitch, play-by-play man on Sunday Night Baseball. And Rabbit, play-by-play man on ESPN Radio this weekend, correct?
Yeah, a little double duty, a little Saturday radio, Dodgers-Padres, and then right into Sunday. And it's amazing, Buster. We've been to L.A. a couple of times, and the first time we went, there was a threat of rain. And here we go again. On Saturday, there's a threat of rain in Los
Angeles. You're kidding. I haven't even checked the forecast.
It never rains in Southern California. Sunday's fine, but yes, Saturday there's again a real good chance of rain, and that's it's just amazing. Part of the way we do our schedule from a programming perspective is to try to schedule games with premier teams in cities and climates where there is a roof or there's virtually no chance of rain. And here we go again in LA with a chance. But looking forward to it. Dodgers Padres is always great.
Yeah, what's your takeaway as we just got off the production call? What's your takeaway for where these two teams are right now? Because I felt this way, and I think I talked to you about it after watching the season opener. Padres are interesting to me.
Yeah,
like to see their progression this year. We know the Dodgers are going to score a ton of runs. They're going to make the playoffs. They're going to be the team to beat in the National League West. But the Padres are interesting early on.
I think they really are, and I think the last two starts from Michael King and Dylan Cease. You know, I don't know that the scales will tip where King and Cease become the two guys that you consider as the front of the rotation, given they have Musgrove and Darvish. But I think their starting pitching, assuming health, and that's a big assumption nowadays, but assuming health, is as good as any in baseball. I think Cease, is a frontline guy and showed it in his last start. And King, after a couple of bulky starts with at least his control, dialed it in his last start. You parade four guys out there that give you a chance to win every time they're out there. I agree with you, and I like the offense. And Cronenworth is hitting the ball and hitting it with more authority, and that's a number three hitter in that order. He has to. So, I'm agree with you on that, and that's why we talked about how, you know, the NL West was and still is loaded going into the season. not because the Padres took a step back without Soto, but because the Padres are really good.
Yeah, I can't wait to, you know, to get to L.A. and have conversations with Cronenworth and find out what's been different for him and what's different about that team. You know, it'll be fun to talk to Manny Machado and sort of, you know, his view on how the team has evolved for this year. So they're going to be interesting. On the flip side, the Dodgers, you know, so much conversation early in the year about Shohei Ohtani. I really felt like when we saw him the last time, he was over swinging. It felt like he was coming out of the box. And all of a sudden, he's gone back to driving that pitch away. Yeah. Everyone was trying to beat him with a away pitch. He's driving that pitch to left field, Carl.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I agree. I think there was pressing going on. I think the ability to compartmentalize things was a bit overstated. He still is, at last check, a human being, but appears now. And, you know, given some of the reports about what's going on with the investigation and a potential plea from Ipe, look, if he knew that all along and was comfortable in the things he said, it would allow you to play freer. And I think that there seems to be a freedom about that. And perhaps, you know, some conversations with some of the teammates and hitting coach about, look, when you're the best, when every lefty is the best, is when you're driving it to center and to left center. And he's clearly doing that again. And look, I don't think you can do enough about him with regards to the audience or the top three in that order. I think when this season is over, assuming they play as many games as they can, it's going to be one of the top three combinations in the history of baseball offensively.
Yeah, and I must say, you know, in our production call we just had, I can't give details yet, but you know, some really fun ideas to draw out some of the personalities at the top of that lineup and to give an audience some insight into some of the people there. On that team. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. Real quick, just to touch on the Ohtani thing that you referenced, you know, we got word that his translator, Ipe Mizuhara, may be in right now in a situation where he's negotiating a plea bargain, and there may be at some point a resolution. I know, you know, Major League Baseball at some point, once there's a resolution of that case, if there's a plea bargain, if there is a resolution, they'll dive into this. They'll have interviews or pursue interviews with Mizuhara, pursue interviews with Ohtani, and then, you know, hopefully from their perspective, they're going to want resolution. I had a source tell me they think it's going to be done with, from their perspective, their investigation sooner rather than later. Jackson Holliday, Carl, last night made his major league debut. It was so exciting to see the excitement about him.
You know, I likened it to this concept of when we win the lottery, they then give you a signing bonus, or in this case, a ticket purchase bonus. That's where the Orioles are. I mean, you look around the infield, and you've got Westberg, and look, you can go the outfield too, but you go Westberg. The shortstop is as good as anybody in Henderson. You got Holliday here. Mountcastle comes up with big hits. This is the team that did hit on their draft picks. And, you know, Holliday, I know you've gone out there and talked about being an all-star, being a future Hall of Famer. He could be an all-star this year. He's that good. And it was a pretty typical start for a kid in his first game to go 0-for-4. And yet in the field and even at the plate, he just looked comfortable. Unfortunately, it highlights the silliness of not having him there on opening day. I mean, that's really what this does. It highlights that for me. Like, we had to wait 2 weeks. That just doesn't make a lot of sense. But look, that team is so good. They are so exciting, so fun to watch. And he's in the middle of it. The difference between, I'd say, Langford and him, I don't know that he moves up to the three hole in the batting order as quickly as Wyatt Langford did. But he's coming off that nine spot pretty quickly, I think. And it's going to be fun to watch his progression through the early part of his career.
Yeah, I saw Mark DeRosa on the network talking about, you know, and he was sort of musing about, boy, you know, if the Orioles were keeping him down the minor leagues for their reasons, and he was obviously making reference to possible service time manipulation, he mentioned that, you know, the context probably looks different now in the American League East because the Yankees are off to a great start. And the Orioles probably are thinking, you know what, let's get this guy to the big leagues. He was dominating in AAA. So that's really cool. And I think the Orioles got this right too, Carl. I love the fact that they assigned him number 7, his dad's old number.
Yeah, that's a lot.
And I love the backstory with, to hear from Billy Ripken and from Cal Ripken about how happy they were that, the first person who's going to wear number 7 since their late father, Cal Ripken Sr., is going to be Jackson Holliday. You can tell, they really feel like he's worthy of that.
I think in a lot of ways, there's a full circle moment going on with the Orioles in that, like, for years recently, it was one of those organizations. It was a hard organization to embrace, to root for, to want to be a part of. And slowly, the last couple of years, you can see this momentum building. And then, of course, the ownership and then the buy-in, the people, beers in the stadium and the hose in the outfield and Rutschman and everything he represents and what he did at the Home Run Derby and turning around, hitting righty and lefty, and his dad, and now the Ripkins re-engaged and being one of the investors. It's like the cool club now, like the Orioles are the cool club again, as they were in the 70s. It's come full circle for me, and the 7 is just another example of how they're closing that circle to complete it. It's a fun bunch. I sat with many of the young guys before Holliday was there last year. It was as cool a thing as I did during our season last year. And it's the cool club to be a part of.
Yeah. Taylor, what do you think about Jackson Holliday getting number 7? You saw the backstory on this yesterday.
Very cool. I loved that they were able to dust it off. And like Ravi said, it's a signifier of a new era. I mean, to have like a soft number retired and busted out for the youngster before he plays one game. I mean, very cool. Very exciting stuff. Shout out Colton Cowser too. Great play last night. Overshadowed by the Jordan Westberg home run.
All right.
Buster, too. The other thing quickly is if I'm Holliday and they're giving me that number, it kind of lets me think I'm going to be around for a while, like a long while.
Oh, man, it would be awesome. You know that. And that's the next challenge for the Orioles, to lock up, one, two, three of those core three stars that they have. Let's do rapid fire on some various topics around the sport. First and foremost, team that you're enjoying watching early this season that isn't necessarily, the team that we watched in the past. Like, we're all going to watch the Yankees because they're the Yankees. We don't want Soto.
Yeah.
A team you're enjoying early this season.
Well, I think there's a division I'm enjoying more than I thought I would, and that's the National League Central. I think the Reds with Ellie are a blast. The Pirates are having a phenomenal year. And I think the idea, and I set this out today, is my thought for the day. Craig Counsell deserved all the money he got, and the prevailing thinking was the Cubs are going to explode, take off, be great, which they may very well be, but somehow like the poor Brewers are getting left behind. Yelich has been outstanding. Peralta's been great. And I think a lot of people, don't think about the guy that's replacing Craig Counsell, and the manager there is a lifelong guy. I mean, he goes all the way back to Arizona State with Pedroia. He's a baseball guy. You ever want to have a conversation with Pat Murphy about baseball? It's old school. It's fun. It's funny. It's informed. He knows how to connect with the players. So whether it continues or not, I don't know, but I'm really intrigued by what they're doing in the National League Central, Pittsburgh and Milwaukee. I think it's a blast. I think it's great.
You know, the team I find them to be must watch for me early this season are the Royals.
I agree.
Where they have Cole Reagans now, and I had this conversation this morning that at the beginning of the calendar year, number one pitcher on the planet was Gerrit Cole, unquestionably. Well, he's hurt. Number two was Spencer Strider. Well, he's hurt. You know what? Cole Reagans is already in the conversation among the top five pitchers in baseball. And so to have an anchor like Cole Reagans on the pitching side and an anchor like Bobby Witt Jr., and a much deeper lineup than what we've seen in the past. Man, they've gone toe-to-toe early this year with the Baltimore Orioles. Had a great series in Baltimore against the Orioles. I think they lost the series, but every game was touch and go. And then the Houston Astros the last 2 days, get a walk-off from Salvi, and then you blow them out in game 2. That is a team that I think is on the rise.
I would not argue. I hope that it allows the baseball community to recognize how great Bobby Witt Jr. is. Like, when you're the best player or one of the best players in baseball and you play on a team that finishes where they finish, it certainly dulls the shine. And I think currently the shine's back on, and you've got to watch that guy play. every night because he's as good as anybody in baseball. And just as an aside, the Cleveland Guardians have been unbelievable. I mean, their run differential is crazy. Not what you'd expect. And on, what was it, National Sibling Day yesterday, both Nailers, you know, hit homers, which was a really, really cool thing.
All right. And lastly, 60 seconds. We're going to be talking on Sunday Night Baseball about this epidemic of pitching injuries. What are your takeaways over the last week with so many voices chiming in?
That there's a multi-layered attack on baseball pitchers' arms. This is not one thing. It's multiple things. It starts arguably at the little league level and goes up, that you can't just put a Band-Aid over one thing or remove a pitch clock or remove the desire for velocity. There's always going to be this chase to be better, more effective, and pitchers are in this vortex where they cannot get out of it because the demands on them to do things that they hadn't done in years past is increased. One of them is to pitch quicker. That's no doubt. But another is to throw it harder, to have more spin on it. All those things have conspired here to create a problem. The question is, what happens next? And I hope on Sunday night we dive deep into it because it's a systemic problem. And the industry, players, Major League Baseball, have got to figure out a way to try to help the pitchers help themselves, because currently the chase for velocity and spin is also a chase for the dollar. And as we all know, that rules everything.
No, that's right. It's players, it's teams, it's organizations, and somehow they're going to have to break that cycle if they want to give pitchers a better chance to stay healthy. All right, Carl, thank you. I will see you in San Diego or in Los Angeles on Saturday.
You got it, Buster. See ya.
Todd Radom, the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen in ball fields all across America or all around the world. Or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, how are you doing this week?
Buster, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well. I was moved, as I'm sure you were, by the Red Sox opening ceremony. You, as a Red Sox fan, on opening day, what was your takeaway? Were they honored Tim Wakefield? They honored Larry Lucchino. A lot of emotion there with the Wakefield's children, being honored by the players from the 2014.
Yeah, well, just top down, I think Red Sox fans can perhaps have questions about how the team is being assembled, but the Red Sox still do ceremonies like this better than perhaps anybody. And that was, to your point, a very moving ceremony. The 20th anniversary of this 2014, which is unbelievable. But Tim Wakefield, heart and soul. I remember sitting there through that bashing in game four, I guess, of the ALCS, and watching him take one for the team. And certainly 20 years later, watching all of those players coalesce around his children, their uncles, as it's been said, just incredibly moving. And we talked about Larry Lucchino last week, but what a wonderful day. And again, Red Sox do that so well.
Yeah, and I think they take a page, I'm sure, that Charles Steinberg, who's been Larry Lucchino's right-hand man for so many years, he was the one in the last day of Memorial Stadium with the Orioles. He was behind that ceremony. And I think he set a model for teams going forward, which was keep it simple. And it felt like it was really simple the other day with the Red Sox. And boy, it was one of those ones, every time they panned into the crowd, you could see that there were fans overcome with emotion by what we saw. All right. So tell me about this week's entry beyond the ballpark.
So Buster, today finds us at 434 Oakdale Place in Northwest Washington, D.C. This is a tidy two-story red brick two-bedroom home built in 1913. It's got a porch and an ornate wrought iron door. Right across 5th Street Northwest, Howard University Hospital looms large. But on April 17th, 1953, the site of the hospital was Griffith Stadium, the home of the Washington Senators. And on that day, Mickey Mantle hit what was purported to be the longest home run in Major League Baseball history. Legend has it that the ball carried out of the stadium and came to a stop in the backyard of 434 Oakdale Place. Yankees PR man Red Patterson measured the distance at 565 feet, which gave birth to a brand new term buster, tape measure home run. Like the legends of the Loch Ness Monster and Paul Bunyan, Mantle's shot is shrouded in mystery, but let's just get to the facts. The 21-year-old Mantle stepped to the plate in the fifth inning against lefty pitcher Chuck Staubs, and he hammered the second pitch deep to left. Aided by a strong tailwind, the ball sailed over the left field wall, 391 feet from home plate. It continued onward over the 55-foot-high left field bleachers, a feat that no batter had achieved in the history of the ballpark. It caromed off the right side of a huge National Bohemian Beer sign and continued its journey out of the ballpark, giving the Yankees a 4-1 lead. A sparse early season crowd of only 4,200 fans witnessed the feat. But here's where mythology enters the story, Buster. Patterson, recognizing the significance of what just transpired, supposedly jumped up and raced out of the press box to follow the ball, declaring, "This one has to be measured." He soon returned, having claimed to have encountered a young man named Donald Dunaway, who was running down the street with a scuffed up baseball. According to Patterson, Dunaway showed him where the ball landed, and he gave the kid either 75 cents, $1, $5, or $10, depending upon the account. Patterson then paced the distance from where the ball allegedly came to a stop back to the ballpark and came up with 565 feet. Mantle doubted the accuracy of that number. And as the years went on, so did writers and physicists who assembled, who assessed the blast. It has been written about and studied in detail, and given the dynamics and the time that has elapsed, it seems as if the truth will never be known, Buster. Somehow, applying modern StatCast metrics would spoil the story, though. As the saying goes, print the legend. Whatever the case, the ball was put on display in the lobby of Yankee Stadium, where it was stolen a couple of months later. A week after that, three boys returned the ball, no questions asked, and the ball was shipped off to Cooperstown, where it remains to this day. Griffith Stadium was torn down in 1965, and Howard University Hospital took its place 10 years later. Go there, walk over to 434 Oakdale Place, and judge for yourself. It's this week's stop on our season-long journey to the ballpark and beyond.
I love that story. And I can imagine that they're probably baseball fans occasionally will pop by and knock on the front door. Yeah, would you guess?
I would guess so. And, you know, one of the things about this segment, Buster, is the ability to go onto Google Street View and take a look for yourself and kind of, quote unquote, walk down the street. Look what this place looks like. Imagine a ballpark having been over there. You would think so. So kind of a quirky journey to the ballpark on and beyond this week. But an iconic home run, whatever the distance.
Yeah, and this to me is one of the top 10 legends in baseball. To me, there's only one number one, and that would be Babe Ruth calling his shot. That's right.
Yep.
The World Series 1932, we'll never know whether or not he actually did, but you got that grainy video, the grainy film from that World Series with him sort of waving at the pitcher, Charlie Root, and leaving it to us to determine whether or not he was actually pointing out the center field and predicting a home run. All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, week two. The Dodgers and Padres recently opened the regular season in Seoul on March 20th. Including the U.S. and Canada, guys, how many different countries have now hosted a Major League Baseball regular season game? Is it five? Is it six? Is it seven? Or is it eight? How many total countries have hosted a regular season MLB game?
I think I know the answer to this one. What do you got, Taylor?
Five, six, seven, or eight. I'll go seven.
I'm going to go eight.
Taylor, you are correct. It is seven.
Yes. All right.
The U.S., Canada, Mexico, Japan, Australia, the U.K., and Korea.
Nice. Way to go, Taylor.
I had six, and I was like, there's got to be another one out there. So that wasn't a complete
You missed Australia, I'm guessing, yeah?
Yes, I missed Australia. Yep.
Yeah.
And 2014.
Yeah, at some point. Well, at some point they're going to continue to add, I'm sure, you know, as they promote the marketability of the sport. That's actually, Todd, going to be a conversation here more and more about where teams on their own. I think the Yankees did this in Mexico City where they're like, you know what? We have a good deal to go down and play Mexico. We'll do the split squad thing. We'll have a team here and we'll have a team there and we'll make a lot of money. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the Dodgers do that in Japan quite a bit going forward in spring training.
It would make a lot of sense for sure.
All right. Well, thanks for doing this. Talk to you next week.
All right, guys. Thanks so much. See you later.
This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter, producer for MLB.com. Sarah, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Buster. How are you?
I'm doing great. I noticed you just jumped in just as Todd Radin was finishing. And last week, we lassoed you into the quiz, okay? And I was bummed you weren't part of it this week. But given that we know the answer, I'm just going to repeat Todd's question for you, okay? How many countries have Major League Baseball games been played in during the regular season? The multiple choice was A, 5, B, 6, C, 7, or D, 8.
No, I'm trying to visualize the great graphic that was tweeted out by Chris Campbell from Key Sports when Mookie Betts hit the first home run in Korea for Major League Baseball. I know that the first home run in the United States was on my birthday in 1876, May 2nd. I remember seeing that. And yes, I'm binding time. But I think, all right, we have the U.S., we have Canada, we have Mexico, we have South Korea, we have Japan.
We have all day, Sarah. You can't run out the clock.
All right, 7.
Oh, you nailed it.
Ding,
nice.
Ding,
ding.
Awesome.
Oh, man. You get credit for that one, okay?
Awesome.
You've got one
Thank
right so
you.
Far this year. Taylor has one right, and I, well, anyway, let's just get on to the, let's play the numbers game.
Number three
is 2. So we have to talk about what Bo and Josh Naylor did on Wednesday. By the way, on National Sibling Day. So in the fourth inning, they each hit a home run. And they've done this before. They also did it last year on July 14th. So there's only a handful of brother duos that were homered in the same inning. And the only ones to do it multiple times are them, the Uptons, who also did so twice, the Rifkins, who also did so twice, and Wood and Paul Warner, who also did so twice. So if they do this one more time, they will be the most prolific brother duo in homering in the same inning. But it's not just that, because this game was back and forth, bullpens having some issues on both sides. We end up in the 10th inning, and Josh Naylor, knocks in the game-tying run in the 10th inning. And then a few batters later, Bo Naylor has the walk-off hit. So it was the third time that one brother had a game-tying RBI and the another had the game-winning RBI, both in the 9th inning or later in the expansion era. On April 6, 2013, the Uptons did this in the 9th inning of a game, each hitting a home run. And on September 7th, 1988, the Rifkins did so with Billy having a tying single and Callie walk-off round out in the 9th. And again, National Sibling Day. I know every day is National Something Day these days, but for this to happen, not just homering in the same inning, but then engineering a walk-off victory, I mean, it's amazing.
Number two
is 20. So we have to talk about Jackson Holliday, and not just because Taylor's reading the numbers for us, but because, I mean, this is the talk of baseball right now. Making his major league debut at Fenway Park, of all places, on Wednesday. So he did not get a hit yet, but we did have an RBI from him on a ground up. So at 20 years and 128 days old, he is the fourth youngest player in Orioles and Browns franchise history with an RBI in his debut. The only guys a lot younger than him to do so were none other than Brooks Robinson in 1955, and then Andy Etchemerrin in 1962, and Ron Hanson in 1958. And somehow I feel like this is not the last time they will mention Jackson Holliday and Brooks Robinson on some notes throughout his career.
Number one.
Number one is, we'll go with 14. So I want to talk about the incredible outing that Tyler Glasnow had on Tuesday this week. Went 7 innings, did not allow a run, did not walk a base, and needed 14 strikeouts. And the most incredible thing about all this is that he did it on just 88 pitches. So his 14 strikeouts were the most by any pitcher in an outing of fewer than 90 pitches.
Wow.
His pitches have been tracked, which goes back to 1988. But I do want to mention, so there have been five guys have 13. Greg Maddux in 2000 on 81 pitches. Clayton Kershaw did it in April 2022. On 80 pitches, you may remember, that was the outing where he was removed after 7 hitless innings, and he said it was the right thing to do. And then there were a few others of 13 on 88, 87, 89. I just want everyone to know that Clayton Kershaw and Greg Maddux each had 13 strikeouts on 80 and 81 pitches, not to take away from Glasnow, but just to say these guys are on another level.
All right, before you go, I'm going to give you another trivia question. We're going to title this one Old Person Trivia. When you talked about the Wehner brothers, okay, Paul and Lloyd, what were their nicknames?
Oh, no, I have no idea.
Wow, Old Person Trivia. We fired back, Sarah. We got you back.
You okay. Know that my sweet spot of old person trivia is like classic rock. If it is in baseball, it's classic rock. It's anything 50s, 60s, 70s. So unfortunately, 20s and 30s is not quite my wheelhouse.
Well, the reason why I remember this, I actually thought they were great nicknames. So Paul and Lloyd Wehner were known as Big Poison and Little Poison.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
Yeah, that was that. Taylor, you knew that, yeah?
Oh, no doubt, Buster. I was ready to shout it out here.
I know this. Todd Radom definitely would have known it. You know, he chief executive of our weekly quiz. All right, Sarah, thanks for doing this and great to talk with you and hopefully talk to you Sunday night.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets. Alrighty, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for a Friday. Bleacher Tweets are brought to you by DirecTV. Get the best live sports and streaming together. No satellite dish required. Now stream DirecTV satellite free. You should call the voicemail box for Bleacher Tweets. We've been getting tons of calls. It's been lots of fun. 406-404-8460. That number is in the show notes. A pair of voicemails. I feel like I'm favoring our international listeners here, but we'll continue that trend. But we'll try and break out of it next week. Here's our first one.
Hi, Mr. and Taylor. This is David calling from Belgium, a small country in Europe best known for his waffles, chocolate, and beer. In 2019, I had the privilege to attend the first MLB London series between the Red Sox and Yankees. I think this event has been great success over the years, but how much has this helped growing the game in Europe, and are we now seeing more European prospects coming through the minors? Thanks in advance for your answer. Love the show. Take care. Bye.
Yeah, I can't say, and boy, that's interesting. I, you know, was at that game too, the Red Sox and Yankees. That was a really cool series. I can't say that I've heard about a wave from club executives of folks coming through baseball who are from the mainland in Europe. You know, but I do get the sense that there's more interest. You know, I'm gonna have to do some more research on that, Taylor.
Speaking of more interest, here is a caller who would like to, a little help keeping up with baseball.
Hi, Buster. It's Dan. I'm a beleaguered Mariners fan from Swindon, England. Love the show. My question is, what's the best way for baseball fans in Europe to keep on top of the news performances from around the league? Most of the games either start or end past midnight, so I end up just watching the Mariners highlights every morning. But it means that I lose track of what happens around the rest of the league.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, first and foremost, I'm going to be a company guy and say go to ESPN.com. You can look at highlights. You can look at stories. I also like, if you have access in some form or fashion, every morning I get up and I watch Quick Pitch on MLB Network because they run through all the games. You get through all the details. And by the time you get through an hour of that, you have an excellent idea what happened the night before. Taylor, does that make sense?
Yeah, I would echo Quick Pitch, the best thing. I don't know if you can get a digital subscription to MLB Network over there. But if not, I would, it's kind of tricky to find. Again, go to ESPN.com first. But if you go to MLB.com/video, that's where you can find all the condensed games. And I love to watch those. If something major happened, and they're like anywhere from 4 to 7 minutes to go through them. And it's a really, really great resource, even on this side of the pond over here. Shout out to a couple of people who didn't make the cut here. Josh in Columbus, Devin in Missouri, Joe in Pennsylvania, and John from the People's Republic of Lakewood. You can email us, bleachertweets@gmail.com, as Doug in Atlanta did. He writes in, on the most recent podcast, Hembo suggested Jose Altuve may be the last person to get 3,000 hits. My question is, why not Freddie Freeman? I haven't seen anything that suggests he's slowing down at all. They're the same age, and Freeman still plays well at first base.
Fair point. It gives us an opportunity to yell at Hembo next week. Can we put that one in our back pocket, Taylor?
I'm texting Hembo right now, so I'll throw that into the mix there. He won't forget. He's got a mind like a steel trap.
Nice. Next Wednesday, we'll follow up, and you might get Humble Hembo. What do you think?
Humble Hembo? Does such a thing exist? Let's go. We got two tweets here. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. PK Steinberg writes in, the umps this year have been awful so far. Bring in the robots. Bunch of awful calls the last couple of days. We texted about one last night in the Orioles Red Sox game. What do you think about it? The strike system, the balls and strikes challenge system, it's got to come sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I knew it. Let's face it. PK is a smart guy, and he knew after that Orioles Red Sox game, if he complained about the umpiring, he was going to get into the mix here because Taylor was all over it. So PK, excellent strategy getting on the Bleacher Tweets today. Taylor, he totally got you.
He played me. Who's pulling the strings around here? PK in the Bleacher Tweets. That's not surprising.
No, in all seriousness, look, I've said this before. If I had to guess, I think we're going to have a challenge system in baseball next year. In 2025, I think there's going to be a challenge system in the big leagues where each team has maybe, three challenges per 9-inning games. And I think it's probably at this point overdue.
Thanks for calling in. Thanks for writing in. Thanks for tweeting, everyone. We really appreciate it. Hope you're enjoying the show being out a little bit earlier on Friday, a little bit of a different format at the top of the show. And we'll keep it going here. We'll be back. We're recording after Sunday Night Baseball. So we'll be back in your feed first thing on Monday.
And Taylor, before we go, I want to just mention, in recent days, as we were talking about Jackson Holliday, when's he going to get called up? You were definitely critical of my man, Tony Kemp, okay, who I have gotten to know through the years. He went to Vanderbilt. I knew him as an undergrad, got to know him since he was a big leaguer. He is such a great guy. And I must say, I want to call attention to the tweet that he sent out after Tony Kemp was designated for assignment by the Orioles to make room on the roster for Jackson Holliday. My man Tony Kemp tweeted out, in the fall of 2010, our college had a series against the Longhorns for a 3-game set. Our hitting coach at the time was Josh Holliday, and his brother Matt brought his kid to our early practice. I remember watching his son, Jackson Holliday, 7, with a sweet lefty swing. He writes, go get him, kid. Taylor, you and I mean, you love stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry to Tony Kemp and to you, Buster, your Vanderbilt sensibilities.
No, I get it. I didn't say anything at the time because you weren't being personal. Like, all you're doing is talking about run production. But I think Tony's such a great guy. And what did that gesture was so cool. I just wanted to mention it.
Yeah. And he was well compensated for his time, too. So,
well, there you go. All right. That's it for today. My thanks today to Carl, to Sarah, to Todd Radom, and of course to Taylor. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day. Sunday Night Baseball this week, we've got the Padres at the Los Angeles Dodgers, 7:00 Eastern this Sunday.